Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is January 28, 1978, and this is my audio letter number 30. One evening last spring, the Beverly Hills Supper Club in Southgate, Kentucky, was packed with customers. They were enjoying a good time, and the troubles of the world outside seemed remote and forgotten for the moment. But in a room away from the crowds, fire broke out. It soon became apparent that the fire would spread to the rest of the club. Someone went on stage to warn the customers to leave. He called for attention and warned them in a calm voice that fire had broken out in another part of the club. He cautioned them against panic, but urged everyone to get up immediately and leave in an orderly manner while there was time to do so. A few people listened, took him at his word, or at least decided better safe than sorry, and got up and left. But to his astonishment, many did not listen at all, and most of those who did listen just laughed and went back to their merrymaking. After all, they could not see any flames, nor even any smoke. And so the man redoubled his warnings, pleading with them to leave before the fire arrived, but to no avail. A few who had doubted at first now realized he was serious and got out. But many continued to ignore him. No flames, no smoke, so how could there be a fire? But then suddenly there was smoke, and a moment later, fire. The fire spread rapidly. Panic broke out as people surged toward the doors. Soon the Beverly Hills Supper Club was a raging inferno, and the loss of life was staggering. Meanwhile, the few who had heard and heeded the warning stood outside, looking in awe at the horrible nightmare before them. My friends, I feel today like the man who tried in vain to give that warning to the patrons of the Beverly Hills Supper Club. 5 years ago, when I wrote my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, there was still time for an aroused American public to stave off disaster. Since that time, I have tried through congressional testimony, radio and television talk shows, lectures and tape recordings to wake up America in time. A few have listened and have even taken action in every way they could to help, and that makes the whole effort worthwhile to me personally. But most of us today will never bring ourselves to really believe our nation is threatened by the fires of nuclear war until we begin to be singed by the flames. As I speak to you today, the flames are already licking at our feet. The forces which were set in motion by our secret rulers decades ago have suddenly turned against them in recent months. Now they are trying frantically to stop some of the things they have launched, but it is too late. While they have been gambling over the years, the rulers in the Kremlin have been playing a shrewd game of chess, and now checkmate is upon us. What's more, a very important shift in power within the Kremlin ruling circles has taken place in recent weeks, whose effect is to accelerate the possible demise of our once great land. My three topics for today are topic number one, the one world plan of our secret rulers gone awry. Topic number two, the aggressive new policies of the Kremlin. And topic number three, the Soviet readiness to police the world. Topic number one. It has now been a year and a half since the Soviet Union launched its all-out military double-cross of our own secret rulers. It all began with the Soviet underwater missile crisis of 1976, which I first made public in audio letter 14 for July of that year. By 2 months later, I was able to detail for you how public exposure of the Soviet threat, even though that exposure was limited, played a key role in preventing for the moment a surprise nuclear attack by the Soviet Union. But once that attack was averted, our secret rulers tried to patch up their alliance with Moscow, thinking wrongly that they could keep the upper hand with the Russians until they had served their purpose. That alliance was part of the grand design, the long-range commitment to create a dictatorial one-world government that secretly was forged early in this century. So our unelected rulers kept right on trying to keep the limping alliance on its feet until disaster struck 4 months ago. On September 27, 1977, America lost the still-secret but historic space battle of the Harvest Moon. Our rulers' military trump card, the secret American moon base in Copernicus Crater, was put out of action by the Soviet Union using an orbital neutron particle beam weapon. Suddenly, the military upper hand had shifted decisively to the Soviet Union. Now the long-standing plans and preparations for America to be ravished by depression, dictatorship, and war are coming to fruition, but under circumstances drastically changed from those our rulers foresaw. Our rulers are trying to turn some of the events they have set in motion into new channels and are trying to stop others altogether. But the momentum is too great, and they have waited too long, blinded by their own greed and lust for power. It is as if the driver of a car traveling 60 miles an hour suddenly saw a cliff 10 feet ahead. He might slam on the brakes and slow down slightly, or he might turn the steering wheel to change the car's direction, but it would make no difference. He would still go over the cliff. Today, the American economy is turning increasingly sour by the day. The slow-motion crash of the stock market that began 3 years ago is speeding up. Stagflation is deepening as unemployment remains high while inflation gathers steam. The dollar is sick, sinking almost daily on international currency markets. Meanwhile, gold, which United States Treasury propaganda has declared to be obsolete for monetary purpose, is on its torturous way up. The conspiracy against the dollar by our own rulers, which I described in my book 5 years ago, is now yielding fruits of international monetary unrest, potential protectionist measures, and economic controls. Angry coal miners are extending their strikes so long in the midst of an unusually severe winter that utilities are beginning to run low on fuel. And now the nation's farmers, caught between high prices for what they buy and low prices for what they sell, are also striking. Originally, these and other economic disruptions were to be used to help set the stage for implementation of a corporate socialist new constitution that has already been written for America. But now, there's no time for such niceties, and our rulers are preparing to use these things to help launch a new Bolshevik revolution right here in the United States. And to help do the job, already over 15,000 of the old Bolshevik faction, who are now being expelled from the Soviet Union, have flooded into the United States, all in a period of only 3 months since the Battle of the Harvest Moon. Last month, I explained why this is being done. Meanwhile, the aftermath of America's catastrophic loss of the Battle of the Harvest Moon is creating violent cross-currents and confusion, especially in matters of defense and foreign policy. On one hand, the controlled Carter administration is trying to keep Moscow happy by seeming to comply with Soviet orders to dismantle our defense establishment under the banner of the Strategic Arms Limitations Talk. Yet, on the other hand, our rulers are doing everything possible to stall while trying to hurriedly throw together something of significance to counter the overwhelming Soviet military might. As a result, contradictions are all around us these days. On one hand, a government study suddenly emerges announcing the conclusion that nuclear war is unwinnable. Then Jimmy Carter reveals a budget that reflects this thinking with great cuts in critical strategic areas. and on the other hand, the funding of tactical weapons which cannot attack the Soviet Union is increased, and the package is sold to the public as the NATO budget. And while Jimmy Carter is busy abandoning NATO by throwing away things the Europeans would like to have, Secretary of State Vance visits Turkey and Greece in an effort supposedly to shore up and strengthen NATO's eastern flank. And in the Middle East, our rulers are now trying to halt the diabolical plan to ignite war which they themselves set in motion. And in this new situation, with the alliance with the Soviets gone, a Middle East war would be damaging to them instead of helpful. The State Department is now trying to stop the sequence of events set in motion by certain circles in the CIA which are leading to war. Most of all, they want to deny to the Soviet Union any pretext for a larger conflict that will destroy the United States. If the Kremlin were still being run by the cautious rules of Leonid Brezhnev, our rulers might buy some time with these efforts. But in recent weeks, a dramatic and important change has taken place, and the result may well be to cut short the pathetic behind-the-scenes maneuverings of our secret rulers. Topic number 2. For 13 years and more, Leonid Brezhnev headed the Soviet Union. When his own Cuban missile adventure under the authority of Nikita Khrushchev failed and humiliated Russia in 1962, Brezhnev adopted a policy of cautious but determined step-by-step advancement in Soviet power. As the boss of the Kremlin, this is the approach Brezhnev followed, patiently and doggedly. The crowning stroke of this approach was so-called détente, a lie which our own rulers wrongly thought would ultimately work to their own benefit in the struggle for world domination in secret alliance with the Soviet Union. But as early as 1973, Brezhnev had to defend his patient détente approach to a strong faction in the Politburo who were becoming increasingly impatient to throw off the charade. They wanted to subdue the hated United States once and for all by swift and sudden military force. But Brezhnev successfully defended his own approach, pointing out that by pretending to be genuinely in league with America's ruling circles, the Soviet Union was being handed money, food, technology, and territory at a tremendous rate at no cost other than continued patience. Most telling of all, he reminded them of the many Soviet programs which were developing advanced military technology to leapfrog past the United States, programs which were unknown to America's ruling circles. In 1973, these were not yet ready, but soon they would be deployed, tested, and produced in sufficient numbers to create a decisive shift in the military power balance. Brezhnev got his way, but not without a continuing undercurrent of pressure from the KGB and military complex in the Kremlin. They were especially nervous about the secret American moon base for the reasons I explained in detail last September. They were afraid that Russia might fail to beat the United States in the crucial particle beam weapons race with disastrous results. And they knew that the CIA was planting huge super ICBM missiles under the sea to threaten the Soviet Union from practically invulnerable resting places in the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. As I revealed in AUDIO LETTER 26, they knew that ultimately the secret game plan of America's real rulers called for a double cross and the destruction of the Soviet Union after America had been brought to its knees in a carefully programmed nuclear war. Finally, a blend of viewpoints became the guide for Kremlin policy. Brezhnev's program called détente would be continued to extract maximum benefit from it. Meanwhile, preparations would also be set in motion for a first strike a surprise attack before the secret American moon base could possibly be ready with its planned particle beam installations. The target date was June 1976. It would not be an ICBM attack, but an attack with zero warning time from within the territorial waters of the United States, and the principal targets would be naval targets. It would be a strike from an unexpected direction with an unexpected strategy, and afterward, the entire conventional nuclear arsenal of missiles, planes, and submarines would still be in reserve, discouraging any American attempt at retaliation. The Soviet underwater missile crisis of 1976 is history now, even though the government still has never told you about it. My audio letters from number 14 onward chronicle the details of the crisis and how public exposure ruined the crucial element of surprise, preventing the attack at that time. But I have also detailed for you the manner in which then-President Gerald Ford knuckled under and threw away what turns out to have been America's last chance in a military sense. A combination of public exposure, honesty, and firmness could still have prevented war, because the coming decisive shift in the military balance had not yet taken place. That chance is now gone forever. Prompt actions of the right kind by the controlled Carter administration beginning a year ago might still have been able to prevent disaster, but instead the administration has been doing all the wrong things at breakneck speed. Now Soviet underwater missiles infest our territorial waters, including even the Great Lakes. Both Soviet land and underwater nuclear mines, about which I first began warning last April, now are planted ready to destroy dams, reservoirs, riverfront facilities, locks, dams, and bridges along our waterways, key governmental and military installations, grain elevators, factories, and other targets. Manned Soviet Cosmos interceptor satellites are orbiting the Earth armed with particle beam weapons, having already demonstrated their ability to destroy our spy and early warning satellites. The moon now belongs to the Soviet Union, and it bristles with particle beam weapons aimed at the Earth. And Soviet hovering platforms, now all manned and armed with particle beam weapons, are floating at this very moment over North America and other select locations worldwide. Against this background of a decisive, catastrophic shift in the military equation in favor of Russia, an important change has taken place in recent weeks within the Kremlin itself. For over 6 weeks, since December 8, 1977, Leonid Brezhnev has been virtually out of sight, reportedly due to illness. The story is that he has been weakened by complications from Russian flu, and that this is the reason he has not been meeting with visiting foreign ministers or appearing in public for several weeks. Even a letter was sent to West Germany a few days ago canceling a major visit there by Brezhnev, again supposedly because he needs rest. But, my friends, Leonid Brezhnev did not merely have complications from the flu, but also acute leukemia and lung cancer as well. By New Year's Day, he was completely incapacitated. So for all intents and purposes, the Kremlin leadership is now in the hands of the hawks. Intelligence sources have noticed in recent weeks that the Kremlin seems to be suddenly more adventuresome, bolder, and unconcerned about what the United States or anyone else may say about their aggressive moves. For example, a massive Soviet airlift of arms to Ethiopia is underway, and the Russians are flying through the airspace of any country they choose, as if daring anyone to stop it or complain. The reason, my friends, is that now the military and KGB complex are now in control, and they are very eager to flex their muscles. They all belong to that secret new ruling circle that controls the Kremlin today, I told you about 2 months ago. But the change in tactics is as dramatic as the contrast between Brezhnev's détente speech and the violent belligerence of his defense minister's speech side by side on November 7, 1977 in Red Square. Also, as I told you last month, the Soviet campaign of intimidation of America is already underway, and it's increasing. When I recorded audio letter 29 last month, 7 floating platforms armed with particle beam weapons had already been deployed over the United States in locations which I gave you. Today, there are 12 over American territory, including one each over Hawaii and the Panama Canal, plus one over Canada. More about that later. I revealed in detail last month how platform number 1, hovering over the Atlantic Ocean east of Charleston, South Carolina, used defocused particle beams to produce violent air blasts or airquakes off Charleston and also off the New Jersey coast. By January 12, earlier this month, Platform 1 had moved inland to hover over a spot about 10 miles west of Raleigh, North Carolina, and from there it again created a series of blasts off Charleston, described by some witnesses as, quote, the worst yet, unquote. The new adventurers in the Kremlin have also begun setting off more and more of the nuclear mines which have been planted all around our country. There are slightly more than 10,000 grain elevators of all sizes and descriptions in the United States. Of these, however, a much smaller number can be considered major elevators, and only 89 are export elevators. They are critical components in our nation's food supply. The day I recorded audio letter 29 last month, on December 22nd, 2 grain elevators suddenly exploded, one near New Orleans, the other at Tupelo, Mississippi. Both were caused by Soviet sabotage, and as I pointed out in my tape, the explosion at New Orleans came 4 months after I warned publicly of the Soviet nuclear mines along the Mississippi River. In the wake of additional grain elevator explosions, we have heard an avalanche of governmental words about low humidity, sparks, and the explosive nature of grain dust. These hazards are real, my friends, but no government official has tried to explain why these hazards, which have always existed, have never before produced a continuing rash of explosions like those of recent days. What's more, listen to these words of a high Agriculture Department official concerning the huge Continental Grain Company elevator that blew up near New Orleans. Quote, the New Orleans operation was considered one of the cleanest. We were very surprised by that explosion, unquote. And the humidity in New Orleans that day was 67%. A grain dust explosion? Who's fooling whom? I warned you last month that this was only the beginning, due to the extensive Soviet sabotage permitted within our country. And in the past month, more grain facilities have been destroyed by Soviet sabotage, plus other targets. For example, December 23, 1977, Tunnel 1 to New York, near Buffalo, early morning explosion and spectacular fire at the Allied Chemical Company plant on the Niagara River, one man seriously injured, sabotage. December 27, 1977, Galveston, Texas, grain elevator belonging to Farmers Export Grain Company. Violent explosion heard 70 miles away, followed by fire. 18 killed. Sabotage. January 19, 1978, Liberty, Missouri. Explosion and fire in the grain processing area. Desert Gold Feed Company. 3 killed. 6 critically injured. Sabotage. January 21, 1978, Duluth, Minnesota, Capital Grain Elevator No. 4 on the waterfront at the west tip of Lake Superior, destroyed by explosion and fire in mid-afternoon. Sabotage. January 23, 1978, near Stevenson, Washington, huge gas line ruptures with an explosion so violent, some people nearby think a war has started. Gas pouring from the main creates a torch a mile high and several hundred feet wide, towering into the night sky. Sabotage. That same evening, January 23, Albany, California, near San Francisco, Alcan Metal Processing Plant explodes violently. Huge mushroom cloud rises into the night sky, and many witnesses are convinced at first that a bomb has gone off. One man seriously injured. Sabotage. January 25, 1978, near Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Grain elevator destroyed by fire. No injuries. Sabotage. And, my friends, there have been many others. What is the purpose of these acts of sabotage? Let me give you the answer of an expert. He's General J.H. Rothschild, Rothschild, United States Army retired. Quoting from his famous book, Tomorrow's Weapons, published by McGraw-Hill in 1964, and I quote, "Sabotage operations are planned to achieve specific objectives. It does not seem logical, therefore, that in general they would be used during a continuing Cold War situation simply for their nuisance value. Rather, they would be used to break down public confidence immediately preceding the outbreak of hostilities, or otherwise tied into an overall design. A sustained campaign of sabotage acts, irregularly dispersed with regard to time and area of occurrence, can produce a constant buildup of public fear and a complete loss of confidence in authority." Unquote. Thus, my friends, the signs are all around us that we are on the brink of a Soviet surprise attack.